this is Allison Sheridan of the NoSilicast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever-so-slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, November 21st, 2010, and this is show number 287. Now, Steve and I are gearing up for Thanksgiving dinner right now. We have this huge crowd at the house every year, and we love it. We take the week off to get ready, which makes the stress level drop considerably. So nice to be able to dedicate Monday, say, to the task of making cranberry chutney. And then Tuesday is only making the dressing. Wednesday, maybe a pie. It's fun and relaxing, and we're not a wreck when the guests arrive. My daughter Lindsay is bringing my mom up with her, so it should be a lot of good family fun. And of course, Kyle's coming home too, and other relatives and friends. It's going to be awesome. But this is not the Food Network, guys, so let's get going. We're not going to talk about chutney the whole time, even though I did put the link to the recipe I use in the show notes. Well, I don't know if any of you guys are these crazy Black Friday people, but if you're searching Amazon for the holidays, I'd sure appreciate it if you'd start at podfeet.com and use the teeny little search window for Amazon in the left sidebar. From there, it'll feel just like regular Amazon when you get inside, but whatever you buy after you're in there will cause a very small percentage to go towards the show. I say it's a small percentage, but when enough of you do it, it really does help out the show. It makes a big difference. I wanted to talk for a quick moment to the live show folks, also known as the NoSilla Castaways. You guys have been such troopers as we've moved from app to create the live show, changed chat clients, figured out how to occasionally get it to work on the iOS devices, and you've held my hand during the great GarageBand debacle of 2010. More about that later. The one thing you've had to tolerate, and not too quietly tolerate, I might add, are the really annoying advertisements on Ustream. It is a free service, so I really don't think it's a big problem that they make them, but they pop up at the most improper times, and they make you go through the 30-second ad at the beginning twice when you log in for some reason. So imagine my delight when I got an email from Ustream telling me that I can have an ad-free show if I want. I was so excited. I clicked the link right away to check it out, and it was $99 a month. Can you believe that? I know the ads are annoying, but $99 a month? I'm afraid I don't love you enough to pay that much to free you from the ads. Last week in my diatribe about how each browser has at least one annoying characteristic, I complained that Safari doesn't have a unified URL/search bar and how inefficient it feels to have the two separated. I bemoaned having to drag my cursor all the way up to the URL bar to do a search on the right-hand side. Somewhat good news, though, both James Austin and Thomas Borowski, Thomas is from thomasborowski.de, wrote to me to tell me that Command Option F in Safari will take me right to the search bar. I still wish it was unified, but Thomas pointed out that you can actually drag the separator between the search and URL bars to make the search window wider. Even though it doesn't look like you can drag it, you can just grab it and drag it. Now, that kind of helps out, but, it's at the sacrifice of the URL bar then. So you get a bigger search area, but a smaller URL bar. So it's kind of a trade-off. I know. How about unifying them, Apple? Well, anyway, thanks, James and Thomas. I'll limp along with Command Option F until Apple listens to me.
Well, hello, Allison and all the NoSilla castaways. This is Robert Carter from the Tech Doctor podcast, here for what I presume will be my final comments on speeding up a podcast. You may remember that last week I suggested you use the VLC, the Video LAN client, to speed up a podcast. Week before last, Allison suggested that one might use QuickTime to speed up a podcast. I decided to try Allison's QuickTime suggestion this week, and the first thing I found was that I have QuickTime 10 on my system, which doesn't support the speeding up of podcast. So I went to apple.com/quicktime/download and I downloaded QuickTime version 7. I ran the installation package and discovered that QuickTime 7 would not install on my system because I already had QuickTime 10. I went to Google and I found out that yes, indeed, it is possible to install QuickTime 7 and have it simultaneously on your system with the current version, QuickTime 10. It's a little bit tricky, but not hard. Here's how you do it. The first thing that you need to do is trick QuickTime into trying to open a file that it doesn't know how to open as QuickTime 10, but that QuickTime 7 knows how to open. To do that, you need a file with an extension .QTZ. That's Quebec Tango Zulu, QTZ. I don't have any of those files on my system, but fortunately, the Google article told me how to create one. What you do is you open up TextEdit, and you press Command-Shift-T to tell TextEdit to save this file as a plain .txt file, as opposed to an RTF file. You go ahead and save the file. It will just be called untitled. It'll have nothing in it, but it's untitled.txt. You then go in and rename that file to untitled.qtz. You next open up QuickTime and open this untitled.qtz file in QuickTime. The Max software updater will come up at that point and say, wait a minute, you need a different version of QuickTime to open this file. Would you like to install it? You say yes, and the Apple installer goes out and finds QuickTime 7 on the internet and installs it onto your system. Interestingly enough, it doesn't put it in the Applications folder, but it puts it in the Utilities folder. But that's okay. It's installed and it works fine. The next step then is to open up a podcast in QuickTime 7. You can do that in a couple different ways. You can choose the file open option from within QuickTime and find your file and open it that way. Or you can locate the podcast itself in the Finder and right-click, or if you're a VoiceOver user, press the VO commands plus Shift plus M, and that will bring up a menu, which is the same as the right-click menu, where you can choose the option Open With, and you can press the right arrow on Open With to expand that menu, and then choose QuickTime 7. And this will open your podcast in QuickTime 7. Now, to actually get to the place in QuickTime where you can manipulate the speed of the playing of the podcast, you have to get into a window which is the AV Media Controls window. And the way that you do that is by pressing Command-K if you're a VoiceOver user. Once you have this window up, there are a couple different sliders there. The first slider that you come to seems to slow the podcast down, and the second slider speeds it up. Mine, for some reason, shows, with VoiceOver at least, it starting out at about 45%. That's actually the default speed of the podcast for some reason. At any rate, if you press the up arrow on this slider, your podcast will speed up, and it does it in increments, which is very nice. You can have lots of choices about how fast you listen at that point. I enjoyed the experiment of QuickTime 7, and I enjoy the fact that it has flexibility in terms of the increments at which you can speed up the podcast. I did not like the sound of the sped up podcast as much in QuickTime 7 as I like it in the video land client. Allison, on the other hand, seems to like the sound of the sped up podcast in QuickTime 7 better. So this is a very subjective thing. You just have to try it for yourself and see what works best for you. At any rate, happy listening and enjoy speeding up your podcast. Until next time, this is Robert Carter, the Tech Doctor, saying so long for now.
Well, thanks, Robert. What an inventive way to accomplish this. I wonder how on earth someone figured that out in the first place. Now, what's really odd is I had no trouble downloading QuickTime 7 with QuickTime 10 already installed. I've done it a bunch of times, most recently after my clean install of OS 10. I have no clue why some people can install and some can't, but thanks for the inventive tip for those who do get stuck.
Hello, Captain Allison and fellow Nosilla castaways. Geeko Supremo from Twitter here. Captain Allison, you expressed your dissatisfaction with RockMelt over its non-obvious way to update Twitter. I also had a similar moment when I was first using it. So, how does one compose a post? The answer is both obvious and not at the same time. On the left side is the list of all your Facebook friends and icons. At the top of this stack is your icon. When you click your icon, a little window will appear. This will display your latest status update, your Facebook chat status, and is where you can pose a new status update or tweet. You can tell RockMelt where to send the update from the drop-down menu. So you can see how it's obvious once you know, but not if you didn't. I like the way RockMelt displays Twitter and Facebook updates. The fact that I can put in more than one account, and that when someone replies to you on Twitter, it has a little icon near the bottom right corner of the tweet that will allow you to view what they're replying to, which makes conversations via Twitter much nicer. If some of you castaways are feeling a little deja vu with all this talk of social integration in a browser, you're not alone. RockMelt is not the first. Flock has been doing this since 2005. So what's the difference? Flock and RockMelt have different basic design philosophies. RockMelt does its best to let you know there are things for you to look at without intruding on the browsing too much. Flock is much more like a stream flowing down the right-hand side of the window. Although Flock does have customizable filters or groups as a drop-down, so the things and people you want to see can bubble up. Is one inherently better? Not sure. They fulfill a similar niche, but in different ways. RockMelt is the only one with a current Mac version, so I'll give them that as a slight edge. But I have a long-standing fondness for Flock, so I hope to try it on Mac soon. As a final note, since both of the latest versions of these browsers are based on Chromium, you'll need an x86-based processor to run them. Oh, and if you really want Flock for the Mac, the Mozilla version still works just fine.
First of all, I think my new title of Captain Allison of the Nosilla Castaways is appropriately respectful. I think I like it. Secondly, your audio recording was fantastic. I hope you send in more recordings. Love it. Thirdly, your explanation makes me want to load RockMelt on my newly installed OS. And fourthly, ever since I did my Nuke and Pave, I've been trying to figure out why SoundFlower isn't showing up in my menu bar so I can easily change audio sources and volumes. Then this week, while I was searching for the email from Caleb to play this recording for Steve, I discovered an old email from Caleb talking about SoundSource. It was SoundSource, not SoundFlower, that I needed in my menu bar. I was completely wrong. So then I was able to remember. And fifthly, I want to read you an email from Caleb from May of 2009 where he first promised to send in an audio recording. He must have worked on this one for a long time. But I think you'll like Caleb's style. Dear Allison, your show rocks so hard it hurts. Well, in a good way. You're possibly one of the most engaged podcasters ever. I always look forward to your show, and mass respects to your family for what they do to allow you to do this for us, the unwashed masses. I wanted to give you more than an email, but that will have to wait just a little longer while I write up the review. Till then, stay engaged. Yes, engaged with your audience. Thanks for the NoSillaCast, Caleb. Isn't that great? I love this guy.
Hello from Insomnia Land. First of all, the problem. I don't sleep well. The solution? My iPod Touch. There are a ton of sleep apps that generate white noise or soothing music or sounds, but this isn't enough to keep my brain from going 1,000 miles a minute. So I listen to podcasts, which leads to another problem. I want the podcast to gradually lower in volume and turn off when I fall asleep, so I can pick up where I left off. This would be great for audiobooks, too. At least I'd be close to the place where I fell asleep. The solution? Sleepy Tunes by Infinite Monkey Designs. You set an angle, say 45 degrees. Hold your iPod Touch or iPhone in your hand, and when your hand drifts below the set angle, the volume decreases and then the audio is paused. This app comes so close. There are just a couple of things that would make it perfect. First, the volume needs to lower more granularly. I think that's the term for having finer steps. This might be difficult because I listen at a very low volume to podcasts with high quality audio like the Nozilla Cast. There's not much space between very low and off. The other thing that would be nice is if it worked upside down. I have an iPod Touch and the earphone cord comes out the bottom, so I kind of have to hold it up a little. No big issues though, really. The app also works like a traditional clock radio. You can set it to turn off in a chosen number of minutes. Another nifty feature is a tension aid. This is the opposite of sleep aid. When your hand falls below the set angle, the volume increases, and the iPod beeps until you shake or tap it. I really like that this app takes clever advantage of the accelerometer. Sleepy Tunes is not easy to find. If you search on sleep or even sleepy in the iTunes store, it does not show up. It is categorized under music, unlike the other sleep apps, which are under medical, healthcare, lifestyle, or utilities. I tried Googling things like iPod accelerometer sleep pause without much success, so I found it for you. It's 99 cents and worth every penny. Sleepy Tunes works on the iPhone and iPod Touch OS 3.1 or later. I'll send Allison a link for the show notes.
I love this solution, Kate. This is fantastic. You're right. It's clever to use the accelerometer to measure when somebody falls asleep. I love the things people are thinking of to do with the iPhone. I mean, it's like, really? It's a phone? It's crazy. Really, really enjoyed it. So thanks for a great tip, and thanks to your family for helping the review as well.
Hi, Allison. Peter here. I thought it was about time I gave you my experience with ScreenSteps. At work, we use several big Excel spreadsheets to calculate prices for our projects. These sheets are fairly complex, and every time someone new starts in the company, they struggle for weeks to get a grip on these complex sheets. These new guys keep me company at my desk with numerous questions that I'm very willing to answer, but keep me from being very productive. So, ScreenSteps for the rescue. I downloaded the ScreenSteps Pro Trial version that works for 30 days, and off I went. I started a new manual and quickly understood how to make chapters, fill them with lessons, and how to add steps to those lessons. Really easy to add screenshots and annotate them with text arrows or boxes in numerous colors. Even add tags is possible. ScreenSteps will make glossary automatically. Very handy. I looked at my Excel sheet and divided it mentally in different areas and made a chapter for each of them. Then I named my lesson and added the location of the cell I was referring to into the title, like Transportation C16. This way, when I exported the manual to PDF, the user can use the search field in Preview or Adobe's Reader to look for a word or for a cell location that he wants more info about. I've put the 40-page PDF manual on our server, and in Excel, I've made a cell named Manual that hyperlinks to the manual on the server. So now, when a user needs some info, he can click the cell in the sheet and up pops the PDF manual where he can type a request in the search box. Works like a charm. Everybody impressed, so now placed my orders at bluemongolearning.com. Oh, I even can add the company logo and colors to the manual to give it a more professional look. Thanks, Allison. Peter.
I love your testimonial, Peter. I never thought of putting a link in the document someone has to work with to the manual that you created about it. That is a fantastic idea. Really glad it helped you out so much. If any of the rest of you would like to check out ScreenSteps, head over to ScreenSteps.com and be sure to use my coupon code NOSILLA, that's not my name spelled backwards in all capital letters, for 25% off the purchase price of ScreenSteps Desktop. Well, you know I love to test out new software the minute it comes out, right? So when iLife 11 came out, I rushed over to buy it during the lunch, the very day it came out. I don't really use iPhoto that much, and I rarely make a video, but I do record the podcast using GarageBand. Now, anyone with half a brain in their head wouldn't use brand new software for the single most important thing they do in a week. But I guess you'll have to start calling me half-brain-head Allison from now on. You know, I guess I just trust Apple. I trust them to write quality software and not give it to me until it's completely ready. Not sure quite why I think that. Haven't I learned anything from the aperture issues I've had? So anyway, I loaded up GarageBand 11 a couple of weeks ago, and I started trying to record during the live show. The interface looked a little bit different, but in general, it was pretty easy to navigate. I clicked record and stopped after a few minutes, and I hit save. I wanted to clip the end of that recording, and as usual, I clicked and dragged in the lower half editor that shows the waveform. Suddenly, a white warning came up saying, "Optimizing for flex time editing." I had no idea what flex time editing was, but I was pretty sure I didn't want it. The warning stayed up for, gosh, it was at least a minute, maybe longer. When it finished with that nonsense, instead of clipping off the end where I had dragged, it had stretched the end. Luckily, I had the live Nocilla Castaways there for me, and between all of us running over to Google, we found flex time editing is a technique to allow people mixing music tracks to help the tracks get on beat with each other, or something like that. Evidently, this is a very cool feature that's only been available in some of the pro apps before now. Okay, that's really neato, but I don't want it. We studied up some more and discovered that there's a very subtle way to avoid stretching out your audio when you want to clip it. Okay, the waveform goes up and down above and below this center line, right? Turns out if you click and drag above that line, it does flex time editing. If you click and drag below the line, you get to clip your audio like you used to. Now, come on, how on earth did something like that get by the Apple interface people? I mean, come on, that's insanity that you'd have to know that. It's not even like you get a little pop-up to tell you or something. All right, so I figured, all right, I'm happy. I know how to avoid flex time editing. So I went back to work and started recording some more. And when I stopped, suddenly there's that pesky flex time editing warning again about optimizing. All right, now I'm not even intrigued anymore. I'm just getting a little bit irritated. But it gets worse. It happens a third time, but this time when it finishes optimizing, the segment I just recorded suddenly shrinks up to just a few seconds long, and it is now entitled File Not Found. What the heck? That's not any fun at all. At some point, the chat room suggested I try not ever clicking in the GarageBand window at all, that maybe somehow clicking I was triggering that flex time thing. They found keystrokes for record, stop, and save. For the rest of that night, all was well. Fast forward another week, and even though I'm using the keystrokes, the chat room had to remind me what they were from the week before, it started happening again. I'm not even clicking in the gosh darn window. Basically, every segment I record, I hit save, and it disappears. Now remember, this is on a brand new fresh install of OS X. It's not anything I did. So one time it did let me finish the save first, and then after that it disappeared. So I said, no problem, I'll just revert to my save version. But the save version had the segment still gone. The chat room started making suggestions of other applications and tools I could try, and I'm afraid I was so frazzled that I was actually testy with George from Tulsa when he suggested I try using my Zoom H2. I still feel badly about that. George is one of the nicest guys in the world, even if he is drilled a little off-center. And, you know, he's done so much for the show. I should mention somewhere in here that I know about the little flex time visual thing. They show you, instead of a regular waveform, they show you a twisted one that tells you flex time is on, and you can hit that to turn it off. What we're talking about here is we're trying to figure out how to never have it turn on in the first place, and we never were able to find that. Anyway, last week, the only way I figured out how to get the show done was to record each segment using QuickTime, saving that file, then dragging that segment into GarageBand. In the end, it all worked out, but it took me an hour and a half of recording to do about 30 minutes of audio. Well, to be fair, the hour and a half includes a lot of time I spent goofing off with the chat room and possibly in this case saying some non-Girl Scout safe words. As soon as I was done with the show last week, I used Reggie Ashworth's wonderful app delete program to remove GarageBand 11, and I was able to install GarageBand 09. Then I wrote a detailed report to Apple and tweeted out that GarageBand 11 was banished from my system. All right, let's make it up to George by letting him tell another one of his wonderful stories.
I'm George from Tulsa, and I'm an Apple zombie. It has been 3 weeks and 5 days since I sent Apple more than $1,000, and every day is a struggle. Are you an Apple zombie? Did Apple's "tomorrow is just another day you'll never forget" intrigue you to tweet about that mysterious data center? When the "day you'll never forget" proved no more than 40-year-old albums added to iTunes, did you still drink Cult of Max Kool-Aid and agree this was the day iTunes triumphed over the old music industry? I had the task, sympathetic awe from listeners please, of going out to buy a new Mac for work, one I didn't have to pay for myself. Just as the reality-distorting word for the 11-inch Air is sexy, the 27-inch iMac is beautiful. The quad-core i5 barely fit in my car. On my desk, it was overwhelming. ARDF speak for overwhelming is immersive. Immersed in wall-to-wall Mac, it was a strain to read the system font when I pushed the computer far enough back on my desk to allow for keyboard and papers. Native resolution is 2560 by 1440, meaningless in the abstract. In reality, it means tiny font. Apple zombies call tiny fonts crisp. Pulled close enough to read, I was wiping nose grease from the screen. One technical review suggests the 27's resolution is a resolution too far for human eyes. Can it get worse? Oh, yes it can. The acre of shiny black glass reflected everything in my messy office, mostly me. If color is what you do, you're looking through a reflection of what you're wearing or not wearing. If the latter, you may want to put a 3M sticky note over the EyeSight camera or sign on to chatroulette.com. Different strokes and all. I had to turn brightness to 100% so what was on the monitor was visible instead of what was reflected by the monitor. That in an office with expensive non-glare lights. Sitting in front of such a bright reflective display with tiny fonts gave me days of headaches. I gave it away, an option not open to most. Cult of Mac greeted the recent release of the 27-inch Cinema display with this truly useful and insightful review. Kalu, Kale, it's a frabjous day. What do you expect from a cult of Mac zombies? At $999, that's the same monitor in the iMac I donated away. $770 more than the 24-inch matte LED refurb I bought in September. Great monitor, no eye strain, no headaches. That's enough difference to buy a new mini and OWC memory upgrade. Best of all, no reflected zombies. The Apple reality distortion field is strong. Displays at Apple stores make the huge 21-inch iMac display look small. Overlit Apple stores enable Apple to run displayed iMacs at 100% brightness, much like Best Buy runs all HD TVs on Vivid. Too bright for home, too bright for work. Don't drink the Kool-Aid. Just say no to over-glossy monitors. Worked to bring back the matte option in the MacBook Pro line. It isn't your soul that Steve wants. It's your wallet.
Well, George, I think I'm in the minority, but I've really never had trouble with glare. I guess it depends on your lighting conditions. In my home office, I do find that I have to tilt the laptop monitor and the cinema display from time to time to avoid glare, but the rich blacks and the beautiful picture seem worth it to me. Now, on the screen resolution, I'm right there with you. At work, I have a 10-year-old 22-inch cinema display, and it's marvelous because the screen resolution is so low, there's no nose prints on it at all. I believe it's 1600 by 1024, but when you spread that across 22 inches, it's just fabulous. I actually move things from my HP laptop monitor onto the cinema display when my eyes get tired. The funny thing is that at least once a week, someone comes in my office and says, "Whoa, how did you get that?" People love that 10-year-old monitor. They really think it's marvelous. And, you know, it's got to make me happy that you don't like the 27-inch cinema display. I'm just sad that Rose wasn't in the live chat room for me to gloat over that. Well, we have a special guest star on the show today, none other than the actual, in the flesh, Honda Bob. How are you doing today, Bob?
Hello.
A man of few words. So a little while ago, you got rear-ended for what, the 28th time in your Honda Element?
The third time in 15 months.
So what, do you stop suddenly a lot or what?
No, I was sitting at a red light. It was a Sunday afternoon about 3 o'clock, and I was on the phone with my brother.
Oh, you were talking on the phone, not paying attention?
I had my headset on. Okay. I had the phone in my hand. I was sitting at a red light just waiting for the light to change, and then suddenly, wham, guy slams into me from behind in a 07 Honda Accord.
Oh, at least it was in the family. It was a Honda.
Well, it knocked the phone out of my hand.
Jeez.
And I knew my brother was still on the phone, so I huddled in the car and said, "Ray, if you can hear me, stay on the phone. Somebody just rear-ended me and knocked the phone out of my hand. When I get the phone back, I'll talk to you again." So,
jeez. So was the car totaled?
Yeah, it was. They it buckled the floor.
Oh, okay.
It was so hard that it buckled the floor, and that's what totaled it out.
Now, let's see, one of the times you got rear-ended before that, I know, was when you had your white step van and a bunch of stuff came loose and came flying at you. Did it happen in this time one?
No, it didn't happen that way.
Okay, so you have stuff a little better secured these days?
Everything was secured in the Element pretty good there, so.
That's good. So now you decided not to replace it with another Element. What did you get this time?
I didn't replace it with an Element because I found out Honda does not make 5-speed transmissions anymore. And
what?
Also, they don't make red Elements anymore either.
So you couldn't even put your sticker on it.
I couldn't even put my sticker on it again. So I figured, well, I'll move up and get me a Honda Pilot. And I got that as close to the red as I could. It's deep cherry pearl.
Oh, that is a good-looking car. First thing I said when I saw it is, I'm going to like waxing this one.
Well, wax it now.
Nah, it's raining out. I'm not going to wax in the rain. I've got some limits.
Okay. But anyway, it's a Pilot. And it's the EX model, two-wheel drive. And for the Element, it took me about 6 months to sort out everything inside the Element there to get everything placed in there properly. This thing here, I had it mapped out before I even got the car.
Oh, okay, because you knew what you needed to do.
I knew exactly where I was going to put everything in the car.
Did you tear any seats out in this one or no?
I took the middle seat out completely. Yeah, I got it in shrink wrap in my garage right now, if you know anybody interested in a middle seat for a 2011
Pilot. Well, autographed by Honda Bob might be worth a lot.
It might be.
So you got everything fitted. Do you like it better or worse than the Element? How do you feel about it?
It's a lot more comfortable than the Element. It's a bigger car. It's a lot more stable, I think. It doesn't move around on the freeway. You can travel at 70 miles an hour without a problem.
Yeah, I think the second thing I said was, yeah, you're going to be a lot more protective when you get rear-ended in this one. Right?
Yeah, this one's got a massive frame on it, especially with a trailer hitch in the back. The trailer hitch is actually part of the frame.
Yeah, I think I suggested to you that you put some big giant spike sticking out of the back of that for the fourth guy. But now, how about fitting all your tools in? Easier or about the same?
It's a little easier, this one, because I put a layer of plywood when I laid the back seat down.
Of course you did.
And I bolted it down to the seat. So the plywood is bolted to the seat, and the toolbox is bolted to the plywood.
Oh, okay, so that's not flying when you get hit.
It's not going to move at all. I can tell you that right now.
Okay, so let's see. Is there anything else I needed to ask you about it? It looks like you have about the same amount of space in general, though.
Pretty much, yeah. I got a little more room in the back because the toolbox is set further back into the back than right at the tailgate.
It's higher, so you don't have to lean over as far.
Yeah. That's kind of nice. That was a challenge to put everything in there so that I could get it out without hitting the ceiling.
That's right. All right, well, congratulations on the new car, but I kind of hope you don't do this again because one of these days your neck's going to start to hurt.
Yeah, I know. But one thing I did put in there, the first thing I did was put in the air horn.
Oh, I'm so glad about that. I'm just thrilled, Bob, to hear that you got the air horn back in.
That was the first thing I did to it was put in the air horn.
Well, Bob, where can people find you?
HDA Bob's mobile service is at hdabob.com, and my phone number is area code 562-531-2321.
Can they send you an email, too?
hdabob@aol.com.
And is HDA Bob's mobile service affiliated with Honda Acura or Honda Worldwide?
Never.
I really enjoyed talking to Bob. That was fun. He's such a great storyteller. If you haven't been over to hdabob.com, you really should, if nothing else, to read his interesting travel stories. They're fantastic. You can tell, like I said, he's a great storyteller. All right, it was a pretty quiet week on Security Light here, so I should be able to pull this off on my own. Apple releases two security updates to Safari, one for version 5 and one for version 4 if you haven't upgraded yet. If you get lazy and don't do it, that's okay. You can just enjoy some arbitrary code execution, a little nice denial of service attack opportunities. You know, it's your choice on whether you want to run software update and reboot or not. U.S. CERT has an interesting warning about how the holiday season is a ripe time for phishing scams and malware campaigns. In particular, they're warning to be wary of electronic greeting cards, requests for charitable contribution requests, holiday screensavers, credit card applications, and even online shopping advertisements. These things go on all year long, but we might get our guards down because, you know, there's legitimate ones going on during the season that are so very similar. Now, my personal rule is if I get something unsolicited, I don't click on the link, ever, 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 but I will go to the source that supposedly was sending it to me, and a lot of times I found out it was legitimate. So let's say I get something that looks like it's from the American Cancer Society, and I usually drop a donation on them around this time of year. I would never click on that link in an email about it, but it might remind me to go to a browser, type in the link to the American Cancer Society from scratch, and then donate. As a rule, I just never look at electronic greeting cards. You know, the risk is just too high versus the improbable joy that could come of it. Oh, and of course, Adobe released a security update for Reader and Acrobat. You know, what would a week be without it? Windows and Mac users both get to play. If for some odd reason you're running Adobe Acrobat or Reader on Unix, though, you're going to have to wait until November 30th to get your update. Well, it's that time of the week again. It's time for chit-chat across the pond with no Bart Bouchats in the house today, but we have another special guest star, none other than Paul Shadwell from Switzerland. How are you doing today, Paul?
I'm doing well. Thank you, Allison.
Well, I think you're best known. I think I just tweeted out that internationally famous chocolatier Paul Shadwell. You became Katie and my best friends when you marched up to the Mac Roundtable at Macworld last year and started handing us chocolate. That's pretty much all you have to do to get Katie and I on board.
Yeah, it seems the same for some of the other ones as well.
The men are okay, but the women will crawl over broken glass to get your chocolate, I think.
I think Ken Ray's the same.
Oh, is he? Well, he's in touch with his feminine side then, clearly. That's what it is. Well, I wanted to get you on the show because you had some interesting thoughts about Macs in business, and we haven't really talked about that very much on the show. So maybe you could start out with your background. How'd you get into all of this?
Okay, so I started a long, long time ago as an electronics engineer, apprentice electronics engineer, and got into PCs when I was working for a company called Sinclair Research. And through that, started getting involved with connecting together because that was the requirement. They wanted to connect these PCs together, so I had to do a bit of research, and that's when I get involved with Novell NetWare.
That's
going back to crumbs. That would have been sort of 83, 84.
Okay, so right around the times the Macs were just getting launched.
Mm. Right. And but you know, in those days I had no I didn't have much involvement with the Mac side. I was mostly working with PCs, IBM compatible computers at that time.
Okay.
And so, you know, skip a few years, and then Windows has been coming in and out of the market, Microsoft solution for Windows has been coming in and out of the market for a while. And finally, when they brought out, I think it was 3.1, it started to become a viable solution for a server side. And that's when I started working. I kind of, like when I switched from Windows to Mac, so I switched from Novell to Windows back then.
Oh, okay.
So that was a big switch for me because then I basically dropped NetWare altogether. I was working more with Windows and more companies were implementing Windows rather than Novell because it was actually cheaper and simpler to do.
Huh. Okay.
I was MCSC. I let it lapse.
MCSC, for those who are just Mac people, is Microsoft Certified Systems Engineer?
Exactly.
Okay. So you have to take all kinds of tests and be pretty smart to get that, as far as I hear.
Well, a lot of reading.
Okay.
But mostly it's because I know this stuff because I do it every day. You just have to know, because I was also a NetWare certified engineer as well.
Oh, okay.
And just doing it every day helps a lot. So that's why I went for that. And also it tends to work better in interviews when you're going for jobs.
Right. That's where it really matters. You might know your stuff, but if you don't have that little stamp of approval.
Yeah. I mean, back in those days, it wasn't as important as it is today. Back in those days, if you'd actually worked with the stuff, it was good enough.
Right.
You know, just having it on your CV was enough, because it was rare to have it, that kind of level. So since then, of course, I'm heavily into Windows servers, Exchange, SQL Server, Active Directory, connecting all these systems together and making them work together. But it gets complicated.
right.
So I've done it for small businesses where you just have one small business server, then extending from there through to huge environments like some of the banks and insurance companies that are based here in Switzerland. In fact, one of the reasons I'm here in Switzerland is because there are so many of them. Doing this
stuff.
I've
heard there's banks in Switzerland.
Yeah, there are.
It's a big deal.
So going through to large companies where, for example, an insurance company that I was recently working for, where I was managing 60,000 users on a Active Directory environment spread across several European countries.
Oh, wow.
So
cross countries, yikes.
Yeah. And so we had what they call a forest for Europe, and there was one in the US and one in Asia. So, and I was coordinating with those guys.
You have to really know what you're doing if you're dealing with banking and insurance information too. You pretty much don't want to screw that up.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, not that other data is not important, but you know, if the fashion magazine had a typo or something, or you know, a little issue, that's not as quite as catastrophic.
It was. It wasn't so much on the data side that I was managing any kind of data, but this is the stuff that controls how the users can log in, or whether they can actually log in or not. So, if the Active Directory servers were down for any reason, nobody can log into the systems anymore.
Right, but that might be a big problem, like with the stock exchange and all.
It would be a huge problem.
Right. All right. So, when did you first start hitting the Macs then?
That was in 2006. I think that was the year the iPhone launched. And before that, I was into all sorts of phones. I was listening to you a couple of weeks ago talking with Gazmaz about phones, etc. Mm-hmm. We won't get into that now. But before I bought an iPhone, I was switching my phones every 3 to 6 months.
Oh, wow.
Because that's how often they were coming out. And, you know, the prices were so cheap that it was... You know, you just wanted to get the next best thing. And it was nearly always Ericsson or Nokia. But since I bought an iPhone, the only time I've changed my phone now is once a year when the new one comes out. So I'm very happy with the iPhone. And it was through the iPhone that I started looking at ways of making it easier, because it wasn't straightforward to plug it into a Windows machine and sync. And anything, if you wanted to do anything a little bit more interesting, you really needed a Mac.
I would tell people that the iPhone's really a gateway drug. You know, people get it, they take it home. And actually, the iPod was originally, you know, where you take it home and you go, oh, this makes me happy. Maybe if I had a Mac, I'd be happier still. It seems to work.
It does. So the consequence of that is, of course, that I went out and bought a Mac Mini. I didn't want to go the whole hog just in case. So Mac Mini was the easiest thing, because I already have got piles of PC parts here, monitors, keyboards, you name it, I have it.
That was genius on their part, don't you think, to come out with the Mac Mini as that little pathway that allowed you to have no risk for very little money you could find out?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And it still is. I mean, it still is an excellent machine. They've upgraded it recently, and it's very good. So I bought one home, and I plugged one of my I've got a number of Dell 19-inch monitors here, and set it up and got it working with a keyboard. And of course, the first thing I did was go out and buy a Mac keyboard because I wasn't happy with the PC keyboard. Mm. So the Mac keyboards looked just really nice, a very thin aluminium plate almost. And of course, the mouse, and then the Magic Mouse when it came out, and then the Magic Trackpad. And then I, at that time, I also signed up to be a developer because at that time you could also buy hardware at discount rates.
Okay.
So I bought a. I already had a 15-inch MacBook Pro, but then I ordered a 17-inch MacBook Pro and a Mac Pro, which is what I'm running now.
Wait a minute. All of this is within the last 4 years? You bought a Mac Mini, a 15-inch MacBook Pro, a 17-inch MacBook Pro, and a Mac Pro.
Yeah, when I get it bad.
And three or four iPhones in that length of time. Good. Well,
more iPhones than that. Oh, right now in front of me I have the original iPhone. I've got a 3GS, a 3G, a 4. Actually, I've got almost two of everything.
Well, the stockholders, thank you. Well, now with all this background, so how does this fold into businesses now?
Okay, so 2 years ago, I was working for a company in Geneva with a friend of mine I'd worked for before, who's also a bit of a Mac fan. But at that time, it was very much a hobby sort of thing. I was carrying around my MacBook Pro 17-inch with me, and I was using it for work. So everybody was looking at it and saying, oh, wow, you know, that looks really cool. So, and I had two monitors on my desk. One always had VMware Fusion running on it, so I could run the Windows stuff and access all the systems via that. But at the same time, doing creative stuff on the Mac side. So I was doing web design work using the Mac side of the system.
Nice.
I've been using things like Dreamweaver and Photoshop for years and years on the PC side. And then when I switched to Mac, I also switched those apps across. And when the next version came out, I bought the Mac version instead of the PC version.
Now, this is totally off topic, but just in case you know the answer, I've always wondered, is there a cross-grade price for people who would do that, or do you have to buy it full up again for the second operating system?
I believe at that time I could cross-grade.
Okay.
Because I had a full license for Dreamweaver on the PC side, and then I did an upgrade when I bought the... I certainly didn't pay the full price for it.
Okay, good.
Whether that's the same now or not, I don't know.
Okay. Completely off topic, just wanted to know.
Sorry. So, moving on from that, so I was using the Mac there, and then that project came to an end, and the guy who my fellow Mac fan... was going to start a new business up in Zurich and asked me to help them with the infrastructure, which is kind of what I've been doing the last few years with small businesses. They start up, I get them up and running, and then I move on to the next project. And this was a case in point. So, and I'd also been looking into virtualization, a lot of VMware and Hyper-V, which is the Microsoft virtualization solution.
Right.
And what we wanted to do was to be able to build up a whole infrastructure, but with almost no budget. So they...
and you chose the Mac for no budget? That's interesting.
Well, yeah, okay, on the client side, that's the way we went with that, and I'll come to the reason for that in a minute. But the idea was that we, instead of having to buy... we had no office to start with, so there was nowhere to put anything. So no place for a rack like we had in the previous company. Consequently, no requirements or no need to think about things like air conditioning, power, and all that sort of stuff. So I said, okay, let's see if I can find an ISP that will help us out where I can just build the whole thing in a virtualized solution, VMware, hopefully, and do it that way. And that way, we don't need to worry about installing any hardware at all in the office, as far as servers are concerned, anyway. And I found a company here in Zurich that can do that with do that for me. And I've got a relationship with them now where we I just basically drop them an email if we need new servers, and they build the server for me, and then I go in and set it all up. So currently we have around 10 virtual servers set up, all within an Active Directory domain.
This is all Windows still, right?
It's all Windows, yeah.
Okay, so
then we go, what are we going to use with the client? And because we were doing the way we were doing this, I also was putting in Citrix ZenApp, which is a application virtualization. So you can run Word, Excel, those kind of applications in the same environment without needing to put anything on the client. So that meant we could use anything on the client side, in fact. So user can bring their own laptop. We decided to go for Macs because, one, they look really good. For a small business, it's also it's a conversation piece when we get potential customers coming into the company and everything is Macs on the table. It's one of the first questions they ask. So it's quite interesting to see that their reaction to that, where it's most companies are using probably Dell or HP. Our office is just full of Macs, mostly iMacs, but we also have MacBook Pros.
So does that make your client look forward-looking and hip and that sort of thing? Is that part of it?
That's the idea, yeah.
Okay.
It seems to work.
So I'm having trouble picturing this. So they would run then, what, VMware or a remote desktop connection or whatever to these virtual servers?
So on the clients, on the MacBook side, we were using VMware Fusion, which is a virtual client which allows you to run Windows on your Mac.
Right.
And that would then allow them to access the system that way. At that time, we were just using terminal service. You can download a terminal, what they call remote desktop, for the Mac. The problem is with the remote desktop for the Mac is it doesn't support international keyboards. Oh. It only supports US keyboards, so it was kind of it was a showstopper, effectively. We couldn't use that. So I was looking around to find something better, and that's when I'd come across the work that Citrix does. And Citrix has a number of products, but they're cross-platform. And they work on the Mac and the Windows and Unix, Linux, iPhone, iPad, Android, you name it, it works.
What's the product called?
This particular product that we're using is called Citrix ZenApp. It's X-E-N-A-P-P. If you go to citrix.com, there's lots of information about it there if you want to read up about it.
Yeah.
It's primarily for businesses. It's not something that an individual would have at home, although you could if you wanted to. There is a free part if you wanted to run your own server at home to do this. It's a bit of overkill for a small number of users. But what it does do, of course, is that it supports the Mac fully, and also the keyboard mappings work correctly. So that was one of the primary reasons for doing it that way. And now the way that we've got it set up, we don't need Fusion anymore on the laptops.
So I'm still having trouble figuring out exactly how this is working. So I'm sitting on a Mac. I run the ZenApp software on my Mac. And then that will...
No,
that's on the server side?
That's on the server side. You just run the Citrix client, which is free to download.
Okay, so I'm running the Citrix client. ZenApp is on the server side, and that allows me to remote connect into a server that... So it looks like I'm running Windows, but I'm actually running it on the server side and displaying it on my Mac?
Exactly.
Oh, okay.
So you're effectively like your remote controlling. So it's like a GoToMyPC, which is also a Citrix application. So it's that similar sort of thing, except that when you log into the environment, you're actually logging into the network. So it knows who you are and which systems you have access to, etc.
So that makes your management of the annoying Windows environment much more limited than if I had a Windows box on my own laptop that I was dragging around and polluting and stuff, right?
Limited? What do you mean?
Well, it limits how much I can wreck it, right?
Oh, absolutely. Sure.
So from a sysadmin standpoint, it's a huge advantage for you of what kind of crapola gets on there and what you can control.
Exactly. Because whatever the user installs on their laptop has no effect on the systems that they're accessing.
Right. And yet they're free to crap up the Mac site if they want to, right?
Yes, and they usually do.
But you can't. You still, to this day, you still can't do quite as much damage to yourself, it seems.
Right. It's not as bad as Windows, although you know, we're still using Windows because of some of the issues that we're having. And I think were we getting on to the next topic?
Okay, sure.
So some of the challenges that have come up with or come across, sharing files, printing, working with people that have never used Macs before, and there's a lot of people like that in business, and dealing with Windows zealots, which is probably, we've got one particular individual who refuses to use the Mac side. He just wants to carry, just does his business in Windows, and that's all he's interested in. So getting around those kinds of issues, now with the Mac, obviously, you have boot camp. So this particular individual, it's sacrilege, I know, but he's running a MacBook Pro 15-inch. He did have an Air initially, but that was too slow for him. But he's using one of the new unibody MacBooks, just running Windows on it.
Yeah, that's funny. I've got a buddy who's got a Mac Pro, and he runs only Windows on it, and he says it's the best Windows machine he's ever owned. He's really happy with it.
Okay. Each to their own.
All right. So what are the problems with file sharing and printing, though?
Okay, so because we're using files in the system, which is sitting in the data center, sometimes we need to be able to get those files down to the laptops or to the client machines to be able to work on them for one reason or another. And we're using SharePoint. And one of the great things about the latest version of SharePoint, we're using SharePoint 2010 now, is that it's actually much more browser independent than it used to be. There was a time when you could only access SharePoint if you're using Internet Explorer, which obviously means that then you had to be running Windows. But the latest version, you can access it from Safari, from Chrome, from Firefox. It works perfectly okay. It works really well.
I know you can't do all the application development from the Mac side because some of the application development requires ActiveX controls, I think, or possibly the Windows or Microsoft specific JavaScript. But is it from the client side? I think that's right.
On the client side, that's become less of an issue. There are ActiveX controls if you're running it in a Windows environment, because linking it to Microsoft Office, for example, it needs to have it uses ActiveX. It needs it, but it uses it to connect the application to the server.
Okay.
And that's that can be a bit of a problem when you just want to use the Mac side. You don't want to start Fusion up and run Internet Explorer just to access this stuff. So that's been a bit of a challenge.
Now on file sharing though, you can put the Mac in Active Directory, right?
Yes, you can. Except that right now there is no connection that we could run Active Directory across. What I'm doing at the moment is implementing VPN into the service, into the data center.
Oh, okay.
And once we've done that, then we will be able to connect the Macs into the network and join them to the Active Directory, which may or may not solve some of the issues we're having. And I'll have to come back to you on that one when we do it. And that should
I'll tell you
for the next couple of weeks.
I'll tell you one problem that you do end up with is the when you save a Mac file on a Windows file sharer, you get that .underscore file. So if I have a file called bob.xls, there will be another one called underscore dot or .underscore bob.xls. It's the resource fork.
Yeah. So,
and it's really annoying to the Windows people because that's what they see. They see two files and one of them's real dinky and they don't know what to do with the second one. But from the Mac side, you don't see it. So you can't even be courteous and delete it. The only way the Mac person could delete it is by going in through the terminal and looking at the files in Unix, and then you have permissions and can see it and can delete it. But who's going to do that if most of the people are running Macs? But you'll start to see that. It's kind of a pain.
I've not actually seen that because we're sharing files with SharePoint, which is it's slightly different than just a file search.
Good. So you're not using a file share.
No, it's not NTFS per se.
Okay.
We're using a file share within the environment, but that's the Macs don't access that.
Okay. So maybe that's moot.
Yeah, maybe.
So you're only using Word, Excel, PowerPoint? You're not using any other sort of applications that you need to share files?
Not really, no. Most of the systems we're dealing with are business applications that have been built for us.
Okay.
There's a specific one which is a Java application. Accessing a SQL server at the back end. So what I do there is I use the Zenapp service to publish that so the users can access it that way. It makes life a lot easier. I don't have to install that application on these laptops.
Nice.
And of course, because it's Java, it's very finicky with the Java client. So in all this issue with Java on the Mac anyway, I've not had to worry about that, thank goodness.
That is good. Now, what about printing? Same kind of problems as file sharing?
Well, printing within the office, it's not a problem because then obviously the Macs can see we have a standard HP LaserJet printer and they all see that with no problem at all. But the machines that are running Fusion, sometimes they can lose access to the printer for one reason or another. It seems to be resolved more in the later versions of Fusion. The latest version doesn't seem to have that so much, but it was a big problem for me in the early days. Where the guys would be wanting to print something from their Windows environment on within the within VMware Fusion, and it wouldn't always work. So that's been the challenge, getting that right. Actually talking to the people at VMware also about it and trying to figure out what's going on. And again, because we're moving more away from that with Citrix and the Citrix client, printing's never an issue.
Oh, good.
So they can print from the environment within the data center to a local printer.
Okay.
Without any problem.
Now, you brought up working with people who've never used a Mac before. What's their reaction, learning curve? Where do they get stuck?
They tend to get stuck with trying to find where their files are, for example. They're not used to Finder, so then I have to walk them through Finder because they're looking for Explorer. Mm-hmm. For the most part, it's much simpler, I think, anyway. So I showed them little things like when you select a file and then you press the space bar, for example, it actually previews the file. So if it's a document or a spreadsheet or an image, it actually pops it up. Even PDF, it'll pop it up
and
preview it.
Single best thing out of all of Leopard. That was my – I would kill myself if I didn't have that now. I love that.
And also creating and managing PDFs, because before we would have to spend a small fortune for each user to have Adobe Acrobat.
Now you use the print button.
Now we just use the print button or preview, because within preview, of course, you can add pages, you can move pages around, you can recreate PDFs, you can shrink the size of the PDF. Yeah, there's a lot more features in there. And, of course, we're also using PDF Pen. If they want to edit a PDF, they can do that now as well.
From our friends at Smile.
Mm-hmm.
Now, just in case this ever comes up again, I'm using Qt PDF on Windows now to just get a print to PDF button on printing. It almost works all the time.
We're with Office 2010, and I think it's also true 2007, you can print to PDF within the application.
Oh,
so
really? Ooh, I got to go check that out. Now, I don't have 2010 yet. I got 2007 on Windows, but I'll have to check that out. That would be awesome.
There's an option to do that.
Oh, very nice, very nice. Now, the thing I find is most bothersome for people who haven't used a Mac before is they close a window but don't realize they haven't quit the application. So they'll complain that it's running really slowly, and you go over there and they've got every application they've ever opened is still open.
Yeah, and hundreds of pages of Safari.
Well, I do that.
I see that a lot.
That's funny. You know, I just discovered something yesterday. I was doing a review of Switcher Maestro for Tim Verporten's podcast, and I was trying to learn everything that's built into the Mac already for doing application switching and that sort of thing. If you push and hold on a button like on Safari, it'll show you all the windows you have open.
Yes.
So that's kind of neat to kind of say, okay, you want to see quickly how much crapola you have open on your machine? Here you go.
Yeah, I've done that a few times. trying to find where the trying to find what's going on. The user says, "Well, I think it's running. I'm not sure where it is." And then I press and click and hold on the icon, and then all the windows suddenly appear, and then you can just go and select the one that they want to find.
Oh, I just found that yesterday. I thought it was a big find. It is interesting that they have trouble figuring out where they put their files, because I used to think that my brother was an idiot. Well, he might be anyway, but on this particular topic, I would be telling him how to do something on Windows, and I'd say, okay, now open the file you just downloaded, and he'd say, well, where is it? I said, well, I don't know. You're the one who downloaded it. Where did you put it? He goes, I didn't put it anywhere. And I thought, you know, how incompetent are you? What is your problem? And I go to work, and I start using Windows for the first time 2 years ago, and it just puts stuff places and doesn't ask you. And I find that astonishing. No wonder he didn't know where it was, because it literally never asked him.
Right. Windows 7, there's a downloads folder.
Yeah, that is a little bit better. It seems to put things there. The mail client that we happen to use puts everything in a temp folder that's buried like 26 layers deep. You haven't got a chance of finding it.
Okay.
So anyway, so this has been about the good parts. What's gone wrong? Or what's hard?
Okay. So, actually, I didn't put that in the notes, did I?
Oh, you've got a fail section.
Oh, fails. I do have a fail section.
I was throwing you a softball there. I was reading ahead. Not that any of this is rehearsed, you people.
I think the biggest problem we have, and that's with users who have a huge reliance on Microsoft products. So Word, Excel, PowerPoint are the three main ones. We also have a couple of applications that have been designed in Access, and of course there's no equivalent on the Mac side for Access. Also Visio is an excellent application. I use it a lot myself, but there are some I'm trying to think of one. There are a couple of apps that do something similar, but nowhere near as fully feature full as Visio is. For example, with Visio, I can even create a spreadsheet of all my servers and then import that spreadsheet into Visio, and it will create a network map.
Oh, no way.
It'll even do that if you give it, if you have the full version, it will go off and search the network based on an IP range. And then produce a network map based on that. And I've not found anything like that for the Mac, unfortunately.
You know, I've got it on my to-do list for 2011, early 2011, to just buckle down and learn Visio, because I just see so many cool things you could do with it. I'm afraid when I want to do any kind of a diagram with little arrows and, you know, boxes pointed at each other and that, I actually do it in Excel. Mm-hmm. It's not that bad. It's a lot easier than doing it in PowerPoint, actually. It sounds really stupid, but you can make connector lines and everything. Mm-hmm. And I know the Omni group people are having a stroke right now at me suggesting that I would do that instead of using one of their tools. But
OmniGraffle is really the closest thing I found, but it's missing a lot.
Yeah, I really want to love OmniGraffle. I've tried, and I like it.
It will. It will actually open. Basic Visio diagrams, but if you anything more complicated, and it throws a wobbly.
Okay. So what do you see looking to the future for this?
For Macs and OS X in business, I have to say, after a couple of weeks ago, the announcement that they were dropping the Xserve, and their focus seems to be more on the consumer product side. It's a bit concerning, I have to say, that if you're working in business and you're supporting Macs in business, you wonder how much longer it's going to last like that, and where is it really a good decision to make if you're thinking about doing that now.
Well, let me ask you this though: I didn't hear you say that you had your clients buy Xserves.
No. So, no, we don't have any excerpts. That's true.
And everybody who's talked about this eventually, that I've heard on podcasts, eventually confesses, yeah, no, we never bought excerpts. It's almost like it's symbolically bad, but in reality, maybe Steve was telling the truth when he said nobody's buying these things.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, the thing is, you can actually, as I am doing, mix Macs with Windows without any problem, without too many problems, put it that way. There are a lot more challenges, and less, if everything was Windows, there would still be challenges, but not as many as trying to mix the Macs in as well. And I think it's usually down to the user, how much the user really wants to learn a different environment. Luckily, I've got a bunch of guys, apart from the one, who were very enthusiastic about the Mac and very happy to have the opportunity to work with it.
That's what I was going to ask you. Now, looking back on that environment that you've built, it sounds like you've had to build some pretty interesting infrastructure in order to manage Macs using Windows applications, using SharePoint, using Windows servers. Looking back, if you had it to do over again, would you still do it on the Mac?
That's a good question. I would probably be thinking twice after the experience I've had, mm-hmm. for sure. Because I can well believe, in fact, that if we didn't have the Mac part and we only had Windows part involved with this, there would be certain things that would be a lot easier. And I wouldn't be getting so stressed over users, you know, just users.
No, there's always still users, Paul. You can't get away from those pesky things.
Exactly. Yeah. But most people in business, that you know, they're brought up on Windows and Office, and it's very hard to get them away from that. So even though there are other solutions, unfortunately, probably the only one out of Word, Excel, and PowerPoint, the Excel, because in a financial institution, they're using Excel, you know, just numbers cannot cope.
No.
They don't have any of the functionality that Excel has for doing some of that stuff.
I know I irritate people when I say this, but numbers is a joke. It's nothing. It shouldn't be put in the same class as Excel, in my opinion.
No.
Just not the same kind of a beast. Are you guys running Office 2011 yet? Or are you running Office on the Mac side at all?
Yes, we are. We were beta testing Office 2011, and for the most part, it's very good. Again, the Excel on the Mac, what a shame. There's a lot missing. I'm hoping that Microsoft will actually gradually build this stuff in.
What do you see missing? Because I go back and forth, and I haven't seen.
Okay, we've got one guy in the office who develops with Excel and he's using Visual Basic for applications. And he's developed what are known as XLLs, which are packages of functions. Excel 2011 doesn't even recognize it.
Oh. It's also missing the... some of the add-ins. What are they called? Now I'm not going to remember the ones that my son needed a couple of weeks ago.
Solver is one of them.
Solver's not there?
I don't think that.
I'm pretty sure that is. That's where you say, okay, I need it to figure out what answer needs to go here in order for the answer over here to come out right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that I do believe that's in. In fact, I think I just played with it last week or the week before.
Okay.
I think that one's there, but it's some of the macros that aren't in there. I know he was trying to do regression analysis, and it wasn't in there.
Okay.
So, yeah, that's too bad. I still think it's a beautiful upgrade. I'm really happy for sure.
I'm using it here. I'm using Outlook on the Mac now much more than I'm using Outlook in Windows.
Ah.
But the guys in the office, again... one of them travels a lot, and he likes to have two time zones set up in his calendar.
Oh.
And there's no time zone function in Outlook on the Mac.
Oh, okay, but there is in the Windows side, huh?
Yep.
Oh, wow.
So on the left hand side where it shows the time on your calendar, you can have two columns for two different time zones.
Wow.
And you can't do that on the Mac. Yes,
that would be cool. You've heard me complain about time zones. Time Scroller takes the front page on my iPhone and on my iPad and is on my MacBook Pro, one of the first things I had to load. So, I mean, you and I wouldn't be talking today or at this time anyway if I didn't have Time Scroller. I find it awful. So I'm going to wind us up now. I really appreciate your conversation. This has been very interesting. I've been curious about how people are using Macs in business, so I'm glad we had a chance to get you on the air today.
It was great.
And by the way, I did get a message from Bart while we were talking. He said he would like to thank all the listeners for your well wishes, as well as stand-in Belgians. I guess you count as a stand-in Belgian, Paul?
Well, I've been called worse.
And I wonder how our Kiwi friend feels about that. But anyway, he wants to thank the stand-in Belgians for stepping in to fill the breach for him. So he does send his best wishes back. So again, appreciate having you on, Paul. Where can people find you?
They can find me on Twitter at Paul Shadwell. That's all one word, PaulShadwell. Also on Facebook as Paul Shadwell. And my blog is www.shadwell.eu.
All right. Thank you so much for spending the time with us today.
It was a pleasure.
Well, many thanks to Paul for standing in on Chit Chat Across the Pond. I really enjoyed talking to him, as you can tell. I forgot to let him talk about motorcycles, or motorbikes, as they say in Europe, or more precisely, Harleys in his case. But at least I got a good picture of him for the show notes on his bike in front of a castle. You should go check it out. Well, if you'd like a good time on Sunday night, you should stop by the live show sometime. The Nocilla Castaways are a really fun and friendly bunch. I'm sure you'd enjoy them as much as I do. On occasion, they actually listen to what I'm talking about, at least enough to give me corrections and tell me when I forgot to record or commiserate with me when GarageBand or Ustream gives me fits. Steve's always there as a moderator, so it's a family-friendly show, too, even when the Hearn shows up. Check it out at podfeet.com/live at 5 p.m. Sunday Pacific time. In the meantime, follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/podfeet. Send in dumb questions, audio reviews, suggestions, or just say hi at allison@podfeet.com. Thanks for listening and stay subscribed.